Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is July 11th, 2006. Today's session is entitled Violence in the Temple, presented by Bob Hawk. Number HA-BOB 2006-02. Let's listen in.
Start. I just came from a class and where I was the student for 2 weeks, and every class the instructor started off by saying, "Good morning."
Good morning.
Very good. Very good. So, yeah, exactly. That was his signal to everybody to be quiet and listen to him for a little while. So I'm going to try that out with my students next year and see what happens. Some of you probably, but not all, actually, how many of you were in the session yesterday? Okay, a number. How many were in the session last night? A few. Let's real quickly, those of you who are informed here, did you take anything away from yesterday's class? This is always a scary part for a teacher. What did you take away from yesterday's session? How quickly we forget now.
No, there have been too many classes.
Yeah, no, I understand.
What I took away is we're talking about the salvation of the human soul in your story. I mean, that's what I remember, your kind of salvation.
Okay, yeah. And I was talking about the importance for me of this question of violence and how that it might seem like an abstract thing kind of off there, but for me it was really significant.
It's a question for the age. I mean, the church is disintegrating.
Okay.
It's one of the reasons.
Okay.
I think that I had a narrower definition of violence, I think, mm-hmm. than what we were getting at. And I think it's, I think I need the definition to be a little bit broader than the one that I brought to it. So
that might actually be it. Something to keep in mind is when we talk about violence, we use that word, but what do we actually mean when we say it? So we ought to think about that as we are going. What constitutes violence for us? That be a good question. Anything else that you took away?
Yeah. One of the new thoughts for me was the idea that the exclusivity of Christianity of our claim is in itself.
So that's an issue. Other things? What about last night? Those of you, some of you were there last night. Did you? I'm going to be using kind of common vocabulary that kind of builds on that stuff, so we can kind of talk a little bit about it. Anybody? What we're talking about, how to read the Bible. And I set up a dichotomy that I think exists in our culture today on how to read the Bible. Either you read it one way or another.
Literal.
Okay, either literal, the way it's set up is literal, or
non-believer.
That's the way that people set it up. They'll ask, well, do you believe that X happened? Was the world created in 6 days? If you say no to that, you don't believe that, then the assumption is what? You're a non-believer. And what I'm trying to do is say, as educated adults, faithful people, I think we have to come to some, well, we don't have to. You can then become a literalist, I suppose. That works for a lot of people, right? Successfully for a lot of people. But it doesn't work very, very well for me, and maybe not for you. And so what we need to do then, unless we want to be put into this category of non-believer, we better come up with some other way of looking at it. So there's a couple of topics kind of floating around, but they're all interconnected. You have to thank Paul Olson back there to put this team together for cleverly working it so that all of our topics were interrelated to each other, and that he knew us all so well that he knew they'd actually fit together like that. It's a good job, Paul.
The spirit works sometimes, I think. No, no, it works always, I know. Sometimes we recognize it, and sometimes I don't think we do. So what's for today? The announced topic, I think, was violence in the temple, right? And what I want to do today is to look at a particular book in the Hebrew Bible and see if we can read it and or read parts of it. And I want to look at Amos. So, first of all, have any of you ever studied Amos? Yeah?
Here, 35 years ago?
Okay. Does anybody, one thing that I hope we took away apparently didn't come out as clearly as I wish. Amos is where in the Bible? Let's start with that. It's in the Old Testament. Let's start with that. And one of the main points I tried to get at yesterday, at least by the end of the class, was it might be tempting to just say, well, Amos, I mean, that's Old Testament. That's not really very relevant to us. Can we get away with that kind of a response? If we say that, then what are we, or who are we? Yeah, we're good Marcionites then. We talk about who is Marcion. A guy who didn't believe in the God of the Old Testament, only the God of the New Testament. And if you even can frame the question that way, if you think there's a God of the Old Testament and a God of the New Testament that are somehow different, then you're a Marcionite, and that the church said that's not a good thing. So we try not to be, even though most of us are somewhere in our souls, we slip into this. So we have to pay attention to Amos. The church said, we're not going to be Marcionites. We're going to have to pay attention to Old Testament. And so even if we don't like that stuff sometimes in the Old Testament, we have to pay attention to it. Why? Why did the church say that? Did you ever think about that? Why didn't they go with Marcion?
Well, we can't understand Jesus without knowing the Old Testament.
Tradition.
Okay, tradition. We can't understand Jesus. Okay. I worry about that answer a little bit, because then it implies maybe that the only things that are relevant to us in the Old Testament are things that we can connect with Jesus. And that's kind of a narrowing in a way that I'm not very comfortable with.
Maybe they thought that it would be harder to grow the church by through the conversion of Jews, because then it would be a more radical break from Jews from their tradition.
Oh, a good cynic. I like this. you think like I do. Yeah, maybe a good practical reason. If we're gonna convert Jews, that's going to be our... Well, actually, they were Jews. So it's not a matter of converting Jews, it's that they were.
Wait, Marcion was.
No, that's true. The earliest church. But many of the earliest Christians were also Jews. I wonder, that's a good question. I don't know who Marcion was interested in converting to Christianity. That's a good question. That's good. I don't know the answer. The way I would talk about it is to say, why do they decide that way? I think what they're saying is that those people that wrote those words in the Old Testament are necessary conversation partners for us. That if we don't hear what they're saying and be in conversation with them, somehow we're going to lose out important voices, important parts of who we are. Marcion wanted to have a small conversation, a narrow conversation, and the church says, what? No, you have to have a much bigger conversation that's going to push you a lot further than you are comfortable.
See, that Jesus took the Hebrew Scriptures seriously.
Yeah, well, exactly. Dr. Beach.
I'm just responding to Susan about those things that would help us to understand Jesus. In fact, I think the early church leaders said that there were many people talking and writing about Jesus whose words were not helpful. And so we have evidence of many writings, not Gnostic writings and others that were excluded from the Christian canon, whereas these were included.
Mm-hmm.
So the reference to Jesus was stronger in some of the ones that were excluded.
Mm-hmm.
This is an afterthought.
In the Old Testament canon?
No, things like the Gnostic Gospels, the Gospel of Thomas, and other writings that did not make it into the Christian canon.
Perfect. We also talked about congregations about these kinds of issues. A great example. I mean, some of you are pastors here. How many did any of you either preach on or be preached to? Was it ever mentioned the Gospel of Judas in your congregations? Okay, one. See, this is not good. That was a huge thing in the paper, right? It was in the newspapers. It was in the magazines. It was on the radio. It was all over the place. And out of all that, nobody, except one and two, preached on that, talked about that in their congregation. What a tragedy that is, because that would give an exact time to talk about these kinds of issues. It's not easy to do, especially in the context of a sermon, but it can be done. And we got to do that kind of stuff, in my opinion. I get a little passionate about that, I've noticed. Okay, so I'm trying to set up, why do we pay attention at all to Amos? Because the church, that means our community, I said, it's an important conversation partner. Now, so do any of you know texts? You all actually know texts from Amos. Did you know that you know texts from Amos? What text do you know? Yeah. Who saw somebody that? Yeah? What, do you know where it is?
No, I only know Jesus.
It's 5:24.
That just rolled out of my body.
Yeah, I think it's 5:24. Yeah? Amos 5:24. But let justice roll down like waters and righteousness like an ever-flowing stream. You ever heard that verse before? Yeah, it's a great verse, isn't it? And anybody ever heard sermons preached on that or that as part of sermons? Probably you have. It's a great verse.
And 21 before it.
Yeah, thank you. That's where I was going next. So we like verses like 5:24. We can kind of helicopter in, plunk down, pull that verse out and say, boy, that's a really nice verse. Especially if we have this sort of literal interpretation, then you can just pick a verse out here and there and it all works fine. But then I rub the nose in the preceding verses, 5:21. Interesting, right? I despise your feasts. Whoops. I take no delight in your solemn assemblies. Well, if you're a biblical literalist, what does that presumably get rid of? Church services. Mm. Even though you offer me your burnt offerings and cereal offerings, I will not accept them. Uh-oh.
Don't have to.
No contribution. No stewardship. Don't worry about that. Exactly. And the peace offerings of your fatted beasts I will not look upon. Take away from me the noise of your songs.
No choirs.
Augie Choir was here a couple weeks ago. That's gone. Cuts down expenses. And the melody of your harps I will not listen. Well, we don't do harps much anymore, so I guess we're okay on that. But do you see what happens here? Is if you take things literally, when people say, oh, I take the Bible literally, point them to these kind of verses and say, okay, well, but they say, well, but it doesn't mean that. Okay, fine. Now you're in the soup then. If you say, oh, it says this, but it doesn't mean it, then you're in the soup. Okay? And that's where you all are, or I hope you are. So when we hit a nice verse like 5:24, though, what questions should we be asking? But let justice roll down like waters and righteousness like an ever-flowing stream. Sounds great. But what's the real issue?
What is justice?
Yeah, what is justice? And what is righteousness? And then we get into some hard conversations.
6:4 and following.
Well, let me take you on a path through this. What I want to get to, I'll tell you where I'm going. I want to get to something called the Oracles Against the Nations, which we'll get to as we go, because they're very violent pieces in Amos and in other Old Testament prophetic books. But what I think, I tried to make a case, and I think we Lutherans have made a case, What do you need to know in order to understand Amos? Can you just take these words literal, like, on the page like this? You have to know his context, and that's a crucial piece. What's the context of the book of Amos? And I'll tell you, there's a debate about this, and it makes a difference of what the context is. There's a group of scholars, and I think this is probably the dominant view today, who say what the main issue of the book of Amos is that Amos believes that the rich are, let's do it this way, are oppressing the poor. We've heard liberation theology, God's preference for the poor. We are all believe in social justice, and that sort of thing. And so one interpretive mode here, one lens through which to read this book says, the basic problem is that the rich are oppressing the poor. When does Amos live? You don't need to remember all this, but he lives at a time when things are going very well in the northern kingdom of Israel. Do I need maps here? Israel is the north, Judah is the south. Almost everything in the Old Testament comes from which of those two countries? I'm trying to tempt you into a wrong answer here, so. Yeah, it's actually the south. We think of Israel as being the country of the Old Testament, but in fact, it's Judah. Every book in the Bible, except one, is written originally in Judah from a Judahite point of view. Okay? Anybody know what the one is that isn't from Judah? Hosea. It's an odd book in the Old Testament. That would make an interesting class too, but anyway, so it's written in Judah, but this book is written about Israel, Amos is, and things are going great up there. They've got a king who rules forever. They don't have term limits there. This guy, things are prosperous. The economy is booming. The population is growing. Alliances are forming. Trade is flowing through the country. Everything is great. And into that situation steps Amos. We'll try and look at that. And some scholars say the message that he has is that in Israel, there's a growing divide between the rich who are making it and the poor who are not. Could that be a relevant lesson for today? Might be. I'm going to give you a different take, a different context for it that I think switches things. But let's start reading it and see what the text says. So what I'm going to do is just kind of read with you here for as long as we can in the time that we've got. Let's not start at the beginning. That's always a mistake in the prophets. Let's start at chapter 4. Hear this word. That's a typical prophetic beginning. Hear this word, you cows of Bashan. You should be saying, what the hell is that about? If you're a literalist, what's happening? He's preaching to cows. Let's leave that aside for a second. What you should have another question. What's Bashan? Do you know? All right. Do you have a Bible that has notes? Maybe it'll tell you. It's a place where they are.
Yeah.
There's
verse 1 of
Sexist
statement. What would it be verse 1?
Yeah. It could be a sexist statement. I think it's worse than that. But Bashan is up near the Sea of, on the other side of the Sea of Galilee in the north, on what today is the Golan Heights. Okay. And this was sort of the Wisconsin of the day. Okay, so many Midwesterners here. So it's where the dairy, the cattle industry was located. So far, we still have them preaching to cows in a certain area. Dr. Beach has it open on a map there. She'll hold it up. She's my show and tell prop. Okay. So you cows of Bashan, who are on the mountain of Samaria, and you should say, what's Samaria? Where is that? Is it in Bashan?
No.
No, it's on the other side. What is Samaria?
Part of Israel.
It's more than part of Israel. It's the capital of Israel. This is Washington, D.C. for the big country of Israel. So you should be saying, what's going on here? This isn't fitting. But you don't know that unless you know what? The context of it, you see? So you should have some things grating on you as soon as you hear those words, but you have to know some things. So you have to study and learn, and it's hard work sometimes. Who hear this word, you cows, who oppress the poor, who crush the needy, who say to their husbands, bring that we may drink. Suddenly now you understand that these are not bovines, or at least not...
politicians.
It could be politicians, except not quite, probably in that day, who say to their husbands, bring that we may drink. Not the politicians, but the wives of the politicians. And Amos seems to be saying, he's not being very polite, you sleek cows who talk to their husbands and say, bring us wine to drink. And who is he talking to? Whose wives, apparently? The people in power, and especially the people in Samaria. So he's saying rather rude things to the wives of the politicians, to Laura Bush, if you will. If you walked in to the White House and called Laura Bush a fat cow, you can imagine the kind of response that you might get. But so far, does this theory seem to be holding? That the problem is the rich oppressing the poor? Are they making this up? I'm going to argue that it's wrong, but is it made up out of nothing? No, it has some sense here. The Lord has sworn by his holiness that, behold, the days are coming upon you when they shall take you away with hooks, even the last of you with fish hooks. Now we're getting some good violent stuff, yeah? Amos says, the days are coming when you're going to be led down the road. What's this hooks and fish hooks business? Any idea? Could just be a metaphor, yeah? God's going to catch you up like a fish and throw you out.
Use you for bait.
Use you for bait, right? But I'll tell you, this probably isn't a metaphor. This is actually probably literally true. We have artistic representations of the Assyrians, who are the big superpower of the day, conquering people and leading captives down the road. One Assyrian soldier with 20 people lined up behind him on lines with hooks through their tongues. Would you do what the guy on the line said? Yep. So this may not be a metaphor, but is it violent? Frighteningly violent. And you shall go out through the breaches, every one straight before her, and you shall be cast forth into harness, says the Lord. So far, it looks like this theory might work as an interpretive tool. But let's just keep going a little bit further. 4:4. Come to Bethel and transgress, to Gilgal and multiply transgression. And you should be asking. It's always about the questions, not so much. You can always find the answers if you ask the questions. What should be the question? Okay, it could be what type of transgression? And to know that, you have to know something about what? Bethel and Gilgal. And maybe in this context. My students don't always know what transgress means. What does it mean? Like to sin or to go against the law, something like that. So go to Gilgal and sin, Bethel and sin, and Gilgal and sin. What are Bethel and Gilgal?
Holy place.
Yeah, they're holy places. They're temples. Okay? And now they're not just any old temples. These are not just temples that are kind of, you know, fly-by-night temples down the road. What are these? Especially Bethel, we're going to get back to.
Or Jacob.
Oh, yeah, Bethel, the ladder to heaven thing. And this is one of the big temples of the kingdom of Israel. And this is run by the kingdom. This is a state-sponsored temple. Amos says, go to Bethel and transgress, go to Gilgal and multiply transgressions. What's he saying? are you going to do with that? How is going to the temple a sin?
Well, you don't go with your heart.
If there's corruption at the temple, which it must be, then you're participating in corruption.
You say that there must be, and that would be a kind of an assumption we have, but we've got to keep reading. Go one more verse. Offer a sacrifice of thanksgiving of that which is leavened, and proclaim free will offerings. Publish them, for you love to do so, O people of Israel. We might think, oh, it's kind of a bad kind of worship. People are worshiping, trying to bribe God, or they've got a wrong attitude toward worship. Does that sound like a wrong attitude in verse 5 toward worship?
No.
Why are the people doing it?
Because they think everything's okay.
And
it says it's leaven, so it can be known like a church. That's a religious tax, no?
Leaven just would be the kind of bread that it is, as opposed to unleavened bread, which they would have at Passover or something like that.
It's bragging about what you've done.
Is that what they say, though?
This is burnt loaf of bread as a thank offering.
But they love to do it.
Yeah.
Free will offering.
Are they doing it to brag? Or are they doing it to boast? What does it say? What does the text say? Now I am a biblical literalist. What does it say? Why are they doing it?
Mine says, I'll brag about your free will offerings. Boast about them, you Israelites, for this is what you love to do, declares the Sovereign Lord.
Your translator, do you know what you got?
NIV,
yeah. The translator there is trying to get you off of a hook that I want to keep you on. They're saying, oh, they're doing it because they're bragging and boasting about it. Is it that the people are bragging about it? It's Amos saying, brag about it. It's not that they're bragging, Amos is saying brag. Why are they doing it? What's the motive?
Well, this interpretation says, how would you describe this worship? One is style without substance, ceremony without faith, faith without action, right words with the wrong spirit, etc.
Okay.
That's what this one
says. Okay.
And my version just says, so you love to do, O people.
Okay.
So.
And so the answer is, why did the text, not the notes, the text says what? Why are they doing it? Because they love to do it. God, wouldn't you love to have parishioners like that? Wouldn't you love to be parishioners who come to church and give offerings? Why? Not because you guilt them into it or anything, but because they just love to do it. And Amos says, it's a sin. Is it because they're oppressing the poor? Well, is that what it says in here? He doesn't exactly say why. Now, I'm going to give you my theory on the book, okay? And we'll see if I can convince you of the rest of it. We got to step back and look at the context again. Who is Amos?
Shepherd.
He's a shepherd. Exactly what a shepherd means, there's argument about. He might be a shepherd for a temple, which might make him an official in the temple. But he's a shepherd, so maybe humble. Where's he from?
Tekoa.
From Tekoa. We all know that. Except now the next question is, where's Tekoa?
Just south of Spokane.
South of Spokane, is it?
Yeah.
Okay. It's a long thing way over to Samaria. Is there really a Tekoa?
Yeah,
I love it. That's great.
Look it up.
Is Spokane the capital?
No.
No, what's the capital?
Olympia.
Spokane is just due east from here.
Okay. Well, I'm just wondering if Tekoa and Olympia might, that might be interesting. Those that live on the mountain.
That's a tough stretch.
I don't know the local politics well enough to bring that in. Where's Tekoa? Amos is Tekoa. Yeah, if your notes will tell you, it's in Judah. And now you should be saying, whoa, wait a minute. So this isn't somebody from Israel coming in and criticizing Israel. It's somebody from Judah coming up to Israel and criticizing Israel. And what's the criticism? Some people say this. And if you want to be safe, take this one. It fits our politics today quite well. Hawk says, his message is, you have the wrong king. And if you have the wrong king, what's going to result? Who's responsible for setting up the society of Israel? Who's responsible for making sure that worship happens properly? The king is. If you have the wrong king, And he sets up the worship, what must be true about that worship. It must be wrong. And so you can go to the official temple of the state of Israel and worship there and do everything out of pureness of your heart. And what's going to be the result? What will you do? Be doing? You'll be sinning because it's the wrong king. So wrong king, wrong society in every way, and I'll play that out a little bit. For Amos, what's the only thing that the people in Israel could do to fix what's wrong?
Throw
the king out. And what king, who does he want? I don't need a name, but what kind of king or what king does he want in the place of somebody? A Davidic descendant. Well, where did Davidic descendants rule?
Judah.
Judah.
Could you show us some texts where that is?
I will show you as we read along here. So now you have my interpretive lens, okay? Does this make a difference on how you read the text? Which way? Yeah, I think it makes a big difference in how you understand what's happening. What I'm trying to do is reinforce this idea of context being important. Okay, let's take a look at. Let's keep going a little bit. Verse 10, actually, 5 verse 10. They hate him. Amos's opponents. They hate him who reproves in the gate. They abhor him who speaks the truth. The one who reproves in the gate. Does that communicate anything to anybody?
The gate is where the discussion of the elders takes place.
Okay. In our culture, we hear gate and we think something that swings like this. What is a gate in their world? It's a part of the city wall. It's a way through the city wall. It usually has rooms built into it. It's the public square. It would be like up by the bulletin board. And what happened in the gate? Lots of things happen there. Everybody passes through, but there's an important function that happens there. That's where the judges sit. Yeah, that's where the judges sit. And so he's here now taking on the legal. We took on the religious system. We saw he didn't like that much. Now what about the legal system? He says, they hate him who reproves in the gate. They don't like the judge. They abhor him who speaks the truth, the honest witness. Therefore, because you trample on the poor and take from him exactions of wheat, you have built houses of hewn stone. You do not dwell in them. You have planted pleasant vineyards. You shall not drink their wine. So we're back to our rich oppressing the poor. But it's interesting. For Amos, I don't think he likes the rich oppressing the poor, but what's the real problem here? It's not that the rich oppress the poor, but what's broken? The legal system that should be there to protect the poor is broken. For I know that you are many are your transgressions, great your sins are. You who afflict the righteous, who take a bribe, who turn aside the needy and the gate. Therefore, he who is prudent will keep silence at such a time, for it is an evil time. So he says, it's the legal system's broken. Why is the legal system broken? Because they've got the wrong king who sets up the wrong laws, and even if it's perfectly administered, it can't be right because it's the wrong king. I'm looking at time and deciding how much. If you think, I'll give you what I think is the clinching text for my interpretation. Go to chapter 7. Most of Amos, you'll notice, if you look, it's almost all poetry, but we have this little prose bit in chapter 7. Verse 10. Then Amaziah, the priest of Bethel, think for a second. He's the priest at Bethel. Bethel's the royal national sanctuary. Who does he work for?
King.
The king. Sent to Jeroboam, king of Israel. So what's he doing? He's reporting on what's going on at the royal temple, saying, Amos has conspired against you in the midst of the house of Israel. Amaziah gets it. What's Amos saying? You got to get rid of Jeroboam. And the land is not able to bear all his words. Now, this, you need a little more context here. Why, some stray hick from Judah comes up and says some bad things about the king. Big deal. Do you think they knew that he wasn't from around there? Israel's the big cosmopolitan cultural center. What's Judah? Judah's the backwater. They talk funny down there. They dress funny down there. He's just a hick. He comes up. And yet Amaziah is concerned enough about this to send a message to the king. Why is he so concerned? If I stood up and denounced George Bush and said he ought to be taken from office, do you think he'd pay much attention? Well, maybe that's not a good thing. Should he pay much attention to me? Should he pay much attention to me?
Yes.
Well, maybe he should, but I don't think, I mean, realistically, I'm not going to care much about. But there's a, that's why something a bit more of the context here is important. Why is Amaziah worried?
You have people behind him.
Yeah, and it's, and you have to know something about the tradition in the north, in Israel. They have a tradition. Of course, everybody knew that God, and they worship Yahweh, their understanding of Yahweh, was on top. Everybody knew that. In Judah, in the south, who comes next in the pecking order? Who's right under God? The Davidic king, right? Called the son of God in some texts. But in Israel, in the north, there's somebody in between. Between the king and God stands originally Moses. The law of Moses. Moses is the one who appoints leaders. And when Moses leaves, his place is taken by the prophet. And if you study the stories of Israel, every time that there's a change in dynasty in the north, guess who's behind it? There's a prophet behind it. Every time there's a prophet behind the change. And so prophets had extraordinary power as a check on the king in the north. And they exercised that power. And here's a prophet standing in the temple of the king saying, the king ought to be gone. And Amaziah says, we better pay attention to this. Not because I think he was so afraid of Amos himself, but because he understands the dynamic here. We've got a real threat to us here. So knowing the context, again, should help. Amos has conspired against you in the midst of the house of Israel. The land is not able to bear all his words. For thus Amos has said, if you don't think he's talking about Jeroboam, here's the text. Jeroboam shall die by the sword, and Israel must go into the land of exile away from this land. There it is. Who's the point of Amos's? It's the king. Got to get rid of this king. And Israel's going to be punished. And what's the only way, that they can get off this hook? What would be the only way? Get rid of the king and swear allegiance to who? The Davidic king down in Judah. And Amaziah said to Amos, O seer, go, flee to the land of Judah and eat your bread there and prophesy there. Follow the money, yeah? Eat your bread there. That's an interesting comment. I'm cynical. Prophets have to eat. Somebody pays them to say their things. What's Amaziah saying? Don't come up to this temple and say those kind of words and expect me to pay you. If you want to get paid for saying that kind of stuff, where do you go? Go back to Judah. Prophesy there. But never again prophesy at Bethel, for it's the king's sanctuary and it's a temple of the kingdom. Now, how does Amos take criticism? Not so well. Amos answered Amaziah, that's interesting. I am no prophet. Well, darn. That's what it says. That's funny. What do we call him? Prophet. Prophet. This is a big problem. This is a problem, and I'm not going to give you the answer because I don't know the answer. People have written whole books on this topic. it's complicated enough. I'll give you one possible kind of simple solution. The word that says, I am no prophet, in Hebrew, you don't know Hebrew, but it's lo. That dot makes it a lo. If you use a different vowel, lu, it means certainly. So he's either saying, if that vowel, and originally they didn't write with vowels. So he's either, he could be saying, I am not a prophet, or I am certainly a prophet. Does it make a difference? But, yeah, it makes a difference. I don't know what the solution here is. But he says he's not a prophet.
What's the nor? Is that just a verb?
I'll check after. I've got a Hebrew Bible with me. I'll look. I'm not even sure that there's even anything there. It might just be an English word. Nor the son of a prophet, but I'm a herdsman, the shepherd thing, and a dresser of sycamore trees. Wait, any dressers of sycamore trees in the audience? I'm not even sure exactly what a sycamore tree is, but Dr. Beach would maybe help. Somebody once told me it's a kind of a fig tree, actually, and that what you have to do is pinch the fig at a certain time to make it ripen. So he's a fig pincher. That's all I know. And the Lord took me from following the flock, and the Lord said to me, go prophesy to my people Israel. Now therefore hear the word of the Lord. You say, do not prophesy against Israel, do not preach against the house of Isaac. Therefore, thus says the Lord, interesting. Your wife, whose wife? Amaziah's wife, will be a harlot in the city, and your sons and your daughters shall fall by the sword, and your land will be parceled out by line, and you yourself will die in an unclean land, and Israel shall surely go into exile away from this land. How does he take criticism? Not so well. Really violent. Talking in the way that men do when they're yelling at each other. Your wife's a harlot, and your kids are no good, and you're going to die a bad death. Now, you might be asked, you should be asking, so here's this hick from Judah coming up to Israel, saying all these nasty things, dangerous things. How does he even get listened to? Why would they even pay any attention to him? If an Iraqi, I'm trying to draw, it used to be so much easier when we had the Soviet Union around. If an Iraqi extremist, however you define that, came and asked to address the Congress of the United States, do you think he would be allowed to do that? Would people listen to him? I doubt it very much. Osama bin Laden says, I got something I want to say. I don't think it would work so well. So how does Amos get listened to? Let's go back. Now we go to the beginning. And here we get into the oracles against the nations. We might look just for a second at verse 2. It's not what I want to concentrate on, but I think it helps bolster my case a little bit. Verse 2 says, one verse 2, the Lord roars from Zion. What's Zion? Zion. He utters his voice from Jerusalem. In other words, in 1 verse 2 already, the author or the person putting this book together signals what's significant about Amos. He's coming from Jerusalem, roaring against the north. And the pastures of the shepherds mourn the top of Carmel, withers. Carmel is Haifa today, the north. So how does he get listened to? He starts off, thus says the Lord, for 3 transgressions of Damascus and for 4 I will not revoke the punishment. What's Damascus?
Syria.
Yeah, it still is. The capital of Syria was then too. So Amos doesn't come up denouncing Israel immediately. Who does he denounce? The Syrians. Because they have thresh Gilead, blah, blah. We could talk about each of these interesting. In verse 6, thus says the Lord, for the 3 transgressions of Gaza and for 4, I will not revoke the punishment. Then he takes on, where's Gaza?
Philistine.
South. Yeah, the south, Philistines. Is that around still today? Yeah. Heard the Gaza Strip? This is it. Verse 9, for thus says the Lord, for 3 transgressions of Tyre, I will not revoke the punishment.
North coast.
North coast. Today, what country? Lebanon, yeah. Verse 11, for three transgressions of Edom. Where's Edom?
Jordan.
Southeast, across the Jordan. Verse 13, for three transgressions of the Ammonites. Also on the other side. 2-1, Moab. What's going on here? Yeah, you see it kind of, he's encircling everything, and he's going to dot the bullseye in a minute. But are they listening to him? And the answer is, yeah, they're listening to him. Why? Because I'm convinced, and I think, of course I think I'm right about that. He doesn't just walk up there on any old day at Bethel. He comes up there on a particular day, a particular festival, and the day is called, in the Bible, the day of Yahweh, the day of the Lord. What happens on the day of the Lord? On the day of the Lord, in the north, it's a time when God comes to rescue his people and defeat their enemies. And probably, not probably, there was some kind of ritual that went with this. And there were probably parades, and there were probably floats, or I don't know. They probably were better at it even than that. And there was stuff that happened in the temple, and the rituals that went along with it. And one of those rituals, I'm sure, included God fighting against the enemies of the state of Israel. And who would those enemies be? Tyre, Gaza, all the Edom, Ammon, all those people around them. And so here's this hick from Judah comes up in the middle of a festival and starts talking this talk. And what do people say?
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, he's a hick from Judah, but he gets the idea. He's playing the game right, yeah? We'll listen to him, yeah? If you want to take a look at chapter 5, verse 18, you'll get my evidence for this. Woe to you. This is the mark of one of these oracles. They often start with hoy, woe to you. Woe to you who desire the day of the Lord. Why would you have the day of the Lord? Would people in Israel like the day of the Lord? Would they like that sense of celebration? Yeah, when you get your enemies all get whacked, it's great. Big festival, lots of food, good wine, don't have to work. It's a great day. July 4th, yeah? Fireworks, the whole smear. And he says, woe to you who desire the day of the Lord. Why would you have the day of the Lord? It's darkness and not light. They think it's a day of light. He says, no. As if a man fled from a lion. You run away from a lion. They have mountain lions? Yeah, they have mountain lions here. I saw it. You run away from the mountain lion up the trail. And you think, oh, God, I got away from him. And you turn and what's there? There's a bear. And you run from the bear. You go into your room. You slam the door. You lean against the wall. And mosquito bites you. No, well. Okay, a snake bites you. Is not the day of the Lord darkness and not light and gloom with no brightness in it? So Amos says, yeah, it's the day of the Lord. And he's coming. And he's coming, but who's he going to get?
I have a question.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're saying that the day of the Lord is a particular festival that was celebrated.
Yeah.
I always learned.
Yeah, it develops into that.
Okay.
The prophets are going to pick up this theme of the day of the Lord. This is actually the first instance of it. And they're going to pick this up, and it's going to become eventually the moon turning to blood and all the stuff that we think of as the end of the world sort of talk in later times, eschatological kind of thing. At this time, it's a real-life festival. Look in 2:4, go back to our list. By 2:4, they must be loving him. Because who's he going against there? For his own country, Judah. They must be saying, "Yeah, this guy's all right. He's like the Iraqi who comes and denounces Osama bin Laden. Might he be able to talk in the Congress? Yeah, we might let him talk."
You say they. I kind of see the context of they. When you're saying they, are these the leaders? Are the common people of any effect at all, or is this just all the kind of the leaders? Upper class,
religion functions has a function, and the common people would be witnessing a especially on these big festival days, they would be part of it and witnessing it. They didn't have churches like we have, where people go inside and worship, but there would be parades, through processions, I should say, through the streets and stuff.
It would be a factor.
Yeah. And that's what these big festival days are about, is the kind of the public face of all this stuff. There's a private face that wouldn't be there. So here's, you know, Amos standing there, denouncing Judah. And then finally, in verse 6, he zeroes in. He's got up to listen, and now what happens? Bam, he hits them for 3 transgressions of Israel. I will not revoke the punishment. Because they sell the righteous for silver and the needy for a pair of shoes. So you can see the theme of rich oppressing the poor. But my contention is, the rich oppress the poor is one piece of the problem, and who's responsible for that? It's because they've got the wrong king that allows that system to set up. And the whole thing really centers around this. And so here's Amos. We're trying to talk about violence, right? Is Amos violent?
His language is violent.
His language is certainly violent. He talks about destroying Damascus and Edom and destroying the whole region around there, and talking about killing the king even.
I mean, yeah, it's violent, but it's not. That seems to me that he's not suggesting that he or like an insurgency he's leading is going to do the violence. The point where he said to the priest, you know, you're going to die in unclean land as a captive and all that stuff, mm-hmm. suggests to me he's saying foreign conqueror, like God's going to take away his protection from this kingdom. You're going to be overwhelmed by foreign conquerors, and that's why they're going to be taken as a slave to exile or something like that.
Okay. You say taking away God's protection. Do you think that Amos thought Israel was ever protected by God?
Maybe, yeah, maybe. But maybe he thinks they've done something that God will remove that.
Yeah, I think if he's coming from Judah, I think he would say Israel has been wrong from the beginning and never been under God's protection. And so the reason I want to, you did a very interesting thing there. It gets us and God off the hook, right? If it's just removing protection, then we're not really being violent. It's somebody else. We're just opening them up to violence. You see? And what I'm suggesting, first of all, I'm not sure that's really true. If I open my, if my son's in the street and I see a truck coming and I say, and he gets hit, am I being violent toward my son? I'm not the one driving the truck, but I think I'm still violent if I don't reach out and pull him away. So I don't want to let God and Amos off the hook here too much. Now, is he himself raising a sword? But he's certain. Would Amos, in the context that he's in, have an expectation and presumably a hope that swords would be raised because of what he is saying? I think that's exactly what he's hoping will happen, and that's what he thinks should happen. Whether he himself raises it is not. I don't know if that's such an important issue. In our culture, let's play that out just a little bit. It's helping me to think. Are you all pulling M16s and shooting Iraqi insurgents? Any of you doing that today? Don't think so.
There's an analogy, though. Say there's a Che Guevara, and there's a liberation theologist that were down in Central America, and a lot of that. I see him more as a liberation theologist who may have been preaching and maybe hoping, but he wasn't out there like Shea. I don't know.
He uses really violent language, though. I will carry you away with hooks and with fish hooks.
Would you say he's inciting to violence?
I mean, we don't know what he did himself. I mean, we just don't have access to that. But it would... I don't know the liberations... what they preached, the liberation theologians preached. But if a liberation theologian preached, pick up guns and go after them.
Well, it's not quite that. It's just he's saying what's going to happen.
He's not telling anybody to do it to him. He's just telling him what's going to happen to him.
Okay, that's an interesting... So All right, let's try that. That's good. So he's naming it, but not causing it. Is that the distinction? Am I picking it up?
Yes, he said the same thing back in Judah. But I don't see that he did.
That's my question. If Amos is so concerned about justice, why isn't he going after the injustice in Judah? I mean, surely that's going on at this time.
But okay. And maybe he did. We don't know everything that gets said. Maybe he did. But what does he think is the root cause of the injustice?
The king.
I would say the wrong king. Mm-hmm. And so even though they might have injustices in Judah, there's not the systemic problem that he saw in the north. Dr. Beach is going to get into
that. Just for a little historical context and a preview of what I'm going to be talking about at 3:30, at this time it is likely that Judah was subordinate to Israel. So that some of these oppressions were on the Judean people in alliance with Israel, but Israel was exploiting Judah as well. So Judah as a client state of Israel. So in a sense, he is defending Judah against their overlords.
Does that make Amos' motives here more political than theological?
Oh, perfect segue. Thank you. Thank you. Come back tomorrow, because tomorrow...
there's a book.
Come back tomorrow, and we're going to talk about... Today we're talking about violence in the cult, in the temple, and religion. Tomorrow is, what's the connection with politics? Yeah, I think it's pretty political. Does that make it less religious, more religious, against... What's the connection between the politics and the religion? How does in the biblical text, how do those things connect or not connect with each other? Thank you. I was trying to figure out how to do that, and you just did it for me beautifully. So we have about 2 minutes. Do people have something they want to say? More? Anything?
Was it telling the people of Israel to rise up against the king?
Oh, well, yeah, okay. Let's go. Yeah, we didn't quite solve this, did we? I think I would say if you walk into a society where prophets lead rebellions against the king, and you speak words against the king, and you're a prophet, are you just naming it?
Well, I think you have an advantage of seeing it. From the outside in,
yeah.
You can name it and see it in a way that the people there could not.
Okay, and what's he trying to do? Just name the thing?
Well, we can speculate about that. It's both ends.
Well, what does Amaziah think he's doing?
He's obviously smart. He knows a threat, wherever it comes from, even if the person threatening doesn't know they're threatening. Mm-hmm. He can see the potential of that.
Yeah. And Amaziah, the priest, says,
I see where this could
be. Yeah, he thinks it's causing, not just me. And I would agree with that, I think. Beach.
We think that sticks and stones will break our bones, but words will never hurt us. Their culture, to name something, was to help bring it into existence.
Oh, good.
So naming was an active verb. And let loose forces that could have actual results. So I think there's a closer connection for them than for us in that distinction.
And the other example I would give is if you look in the book of Kings where the charge is given to Elijah, another great text we can't read today, but there God tells him, go to Damascus and overthrow the king there. It's clear, it's causative there, not just naming that the king will be overthrown, and then do the same thing in Israel, put Jehu on the throne there.
Well, that's true now, we just have to name it.
Yeah. Well, that's okay,
tomorrow.
Now we have...
tomorrow.
That's okay, it's tomorrow, but it's another question. We might have there might be differences among us about whether that's a good thing or a bad thing. But those are the conversations we should be having in a church, right? That's the conversation we should maybe be having. Is this something that's systemically bad or not? Is it evil? Is it not? Those would be good conversations. Thank you all.
Thank you.